You know, one thing that's interesting that I found about being a parent is, like, the other day I was, like, had this song stuck in my head, and I'm like, this is fun. Like, I like this song. What is this? It's a banger. That's what the kids say.
Sure.
It slaps. You know, that's what the kid slang. And then I'm like, oh, this is the Clifford the Big Red Dog theme song.
No.
All right, welcome back to the Beyond Sunday podcast. We're exploring how to take our faith beyond Sunday morning. This is Patrick Nazaroff. With me, as always, Pastor David Bowser.
How are we doing, Patrick?
And Elise McCarter.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent, excellent.
Hey, welcome back, you two. Glad to have other people with me again.
I know.
It was lonely in the podcast world last week.
You did a wonderful job last week on your own. We're happy to be back with you.
Well, if there's one thing that I can say as a gift, it's talking to myself for unlimited amounts of time. So.
Sure.
The dream. Yeah.
Now people just know what's going on in my head all the time, because that's basically what the podcast was last week.
They're just preaching constantly to an audience of one.
Yep, exactly.
And sometimes you do on Sunday mornings, too, to also an audience of one. That was a joke.
You know, that's all right.
You know.
That's
fine. We pay attention. That's
they can't all be good, Patrick. Sorry.
Yeah, well, we're happy to be back in the studio today, all three of us. And by in the studio, we mean in our individual homes.
The metaphorical studio. That's right.
Yeah. So I've got some news here.
All right.
Take a look at. All right. So in Japan, you know, everybody's dealing with corona.
Have any of us been to Japan? I've not.
I've not. Oh, ooh, Elise
has been to Japan.
Elise is a world traveler.
Listen, I was supposed to go to Japan again.
Oh, man.
And then the Rona happened.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Well, the Fuji Q Highland Amusement Park has opened.
Uh-huh.
Their numbers are low enough in Japan that they're opening stuff up. Hey, numbers aren't that low here, and we're still opening up our theme parks.
Yeah.
So,
whatever.
You know, like, you know, and but they do have a request for their roller coaster riders.
Okay,
oh, I know what this is.
Instead of screaming and potentially spreading water droplets out in the air with coronavirus, they ask you to please scream inside your heart.
Aw, that's lovely. Scream inside.
So
your heart.
On the roller coaster, you wear a mask and you please scream in your heart.
Yeah. I just realized I was like making a face, and I realized our listeners can't, you know, see me doing things. So it's hard to demonstrate screaming inside my heart.
I'm always screaming inside my heart.
Yeah, I did see that could be the theme of 2020. Is just scream inside your heart.
Yep. Yes. I can see T-shirts, right? 2020, scream inside your hearts.
So they do have a promotional video of one of their roller coasters. It's just like 4 minutes long of the roller coaster. It's two men in business suits wearing masks looking so bored on a roller coaster. Screaming in their hearts. They're just sitting there. Like.
That's pretty great.
Yeah. So would you want to go to a roller coaster and only, or a theme park and only scream inside your heart?
Yeah, I'd be down.
Yeah, I don't scream anyway on roller coasters.
I mean, I'm the guy who's just like, is obnoxious and talking just to, you know, entertain myself on roller coasters, so
sure,
it would be a challenge, but I'd still go, because the thrill of the roller coaster is not the screaming, so I'd still go to enjoy that.
I like how you said you need to entertain yourself on roller coasters by talking. I'm confused by this.
But like, you know, you're going up the hill, and some of these hills are really big, so it takes a long time to get up them, and so, you know, you kind of make jokes about, like, oh, you know, what if this bolt fell out, or, oh, man,
oh,
you're mad.
Good joke.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I reserve the screaming inside my heart when I'm looking at the price of, like, food and, you know, snacks. That's the screaming inside my heart.
Yeah.
That's where that comes. Or when you're leaving Disney World after a week and you're like, let's check the bank account. That's the scream inside
the
heart.
Don't do that. Nope.
Yeah, that's what that is.
No good comes from that ever.
Don't look for at least another pay period. That's
right. Yeah. Pretend it's not happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, if screaming inside your heart is not something you're interested in, I have another news story here that also relates to screaming about Iceland.
Ooh, we've talked about Iceland before.
We have. Yeah, people frustrated by lockdown in Iceland can release their screams over loud speaker. That is the headline here. So this is a program here, I guess, by the National Tourist Board, that you can record a scream,
okay,
send it in, and they will play it over the loudspeakers in like the non-populated parts of Iceland.
All right, new podcast segment idea. Listeners, send in your recorded screams, and we'll have a podcast segment, Beyond Sunday Screams. Great. Beyond the Scream. It'll be a little segment here. You just send it in, and we will play that on the podcast.
We should do some for every episode in the month of October leading up to Halloween.
It. Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah.
If you want to website... send in a recording of yourself screaming in your heart, you can do that also. And it'll just be
silence.
The sound of silence, yeah. The website reads, "You've been through a lot this year. It looks like you need the perfect place to let your frustrations out. Somewhere big, vast, and untouched. It looks like you need Iceland."
So, is there a cost to this? Do I have to pay to scream in the middle of nowhere?
I don't know. I could not see that information. I don't believe so.
So this is open to foreigners as well. I could scream in Iceland.
But you can't. Yeah, you can't scream out the attempt to convert people to your faith because they don't like that in Iceland. We've covered that before. They're not. Okay.
That is
not big fans.
Iceland is very strict against the Christian message. They if you had not listened to, I guess it was probably last fall, they did put out that they felt Christianity was a mental illness. They're screaming over loudspeakers, and they want to talk about us.
You're calling crazy now, Iceland. Right.
Freaking Vikings.
At least we scream in our hearts like normal people, all right?
Yeah. All right, let's get on to our main topic this evening. Before we get there, have you heard of cancel culture?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. I probably have a misinformed understanding of what it really means, but I have a general vague interpretation.
Yeah, and you want to take a stab at, like, how can we define that for audience listeners?
That sounds like a great thing for Elise to do, I think.
Sure. I'll take it. So I see it most frequently in social media, especially Twitter seems to be, like, sort of a hot spot for cancel culture. My personal feelings on this is because Twitter is sort of, like, emerging of like alt-right and like far left. That seems to be like the political views that are most vocal on Twitter. You know, all kinds of great stuff comes from that. But essentially what cancel culture is pressure exerted on people or sometimes businesses by other people, influencers, other businesses, organizations to boycott any of their... I see it most frequently with, like, writers because that's the world I'm involved in. To boycott their work, for their agents or their publishers to fire them, for people to stop supporting them, that sort of thing. And I think the goal, you know, at its core is, like, accountability and social change. However, I think that there is definitely room for debate about how effective or positive cancel culture is.
Yes, I think that's a pretty good definition there, Lisa. So, like, this idea of, like, through social media you can either A, get a business or person to change behavior, or basically say what they have to say about anything else is now invalid or not worth listening to because of either remarks that you find distasteful, or associations that you find distasteful. And I think Twitter is probably a good place. That I like that you said, like, it's kind of like this extremes right or extreme left both have prominent vocal places on Twitter. And I think also in Twitter with, like, that character limit, like, I think people are at a rush now on Twitter to kind of give, like, their hottest take immediately.
Yep.
Like, they don't want to let anything really digest or think things through or consider it. It's like, this is something happening. We need to address it right now as it's happening. And that can lead to sometimes some premature canceling or some takes that maybe aren't really that all correct because you're not getting all the information. So this is from the Religious News Service, religiousnews.com. An article here by Jonathan Merritt. And the headline says this: "Evangelicals perfected cancel culture. Now it's coming for them."
Ooh.
All right.
Yeah, no dun, dun, dun. It's at your front door.
Scream inside your heart.
So I think the evangelical right knows how to do, it's how to scream inside their hearts.
I've been to some Baptist worships. They're not screaming inside their hearts. Okay, that's a Lutheran worship service that you're talking about.
Right.
So they're very expressive. So this story opens with a story of a man named Chris Hodges, senior pastor of Church of the Highlands in Alabama. So he's a pastor of a mega church in Alabama.
What Highlands are there in Alabama?
Yeah, I did not see that coming.
Yeah, you know.
Church of the Highlands. I'm like, okay, you know, Tennessee, sure. Colorado, yeah.
Scotland, maybe?
Scotland,
perhaps.
Yeah, there you go. Scotland, yeah. Nope. Alabama, okay.
Yes, he is a Highlander in Alabama.
No, he's not.
Mega church, 60,000 members across 24 locations.
That's like a big city, okay.
Yeah. Came under fire because he liked several posts on Twitter by Charlie Kirk, a controversial pro-Trump activist. Are you familiar with Charlie Kirk?
I'm not.
I've seen some of his work. Mostly, I think I've seen people making fun of some of his works.
Sure.
So I can't really say I'm super familiar with him, but I do know he is a conservative, pro-Trump guy.
This pastor liked his tweet.
And he liked the tweets.
Okay.
The posts and questions were considered racially insensitive and, among other things, questioned whether white privilege actually exists. All right, so those are the flavor of quotes that he may have liked. Again, this article does not have them, so I can't speak to the tweets itself. But these things got out. Screenshots of this pastor liking these tweets went out. Mm-hmm. And then Pastor Hodges and Church of the Highlands got canceled. City of Birmingham rejected his contract to meet in schools on Sunday mornings. Other churches, other black churches especially nearby, came out and started, you know, speaking against Church of the Highlands. Even some things that they were trying to do for the city or for the community, their contracts ended up getting cut and canceled over these things. Pastor Hodges attempted to fix the problem by deleting his social media, I guess, you know, like, hey, it's gone. You know, it doesn't exist anymore.
That's right.
Evidently, he did not, you know, sometimes we tell our children, hey, anything you post on the internet is there forever.
Yep.
He maybe have missed that lesson, so he tried to delete it. And there you go. So he has been silenced and canceled from those things. And I don't think maybe his... out of his 60,000 members, I doubt he lost that many people that were already connected to his flock there. I don't think that happened. But you did see, like, because of his actions, parts of the ministry of that church were hampered by cancel culture. So this is how the article opens. I will start here. What do we think about this? Is this, like, is this justice in action? Is this... Twitter overreach? What is this?
I think this one's a little bit tough.
Yeah.
Because you want to, especially I think as Christians, you want to leave room for a conversation and growth and people having, you know, varied opinions and stuff like that. However, some opinions are really crappy. And especially, you know, when they contribute directly to harming or, you know, furthering, I don't know, racist or, unjustified stereotypes or opinions or whatever. Yeah. It seems to me like maybe a better tactic with this would have been just replacing the pastor rather than trying to cancel the whole church or whatever, because I mean 60,000 members, you know, there's not everybody is going to support or agree with their pastor's viewpoint, you know. So I don't like.
I agree. I think it's tough. Yeah.
What's interesting is it doesn't seem like the church has had much of a reaction at all other than him trying to apologize and delete his tweets, right?
Sure.
And the city of Birmingham has no authority to remove him as a pastor. You know, they took kind of what they say, look, this, we don't want to support this kind of ideology, and so we're not going to allow you to continue to meet in our schools. And in the same way, I would imagine they would say to, you know, a KKK group that wanted to come in and wanted to, you know, use their schools to have weekly meetings, the city of Birmingham would probably also say, no, thank you. That's not something we're going to allow to have happen. But this is certainly, you know, I guess I come at this from two sides. As a private citizen, you know, I can see how this is difficult, but as a fellow pastor, I'm aware that anything that I say and do reflects not only on myself, but on the ministry of the church and of the ministry of mm-hmm. Jesus Christ. And so I have a heightened awareness that, you know, my presence on social media, my presence on Facebook, what I like, what I don't like, what I comment on or what I post myself, that reflects on my congregation and that reflects more largely on Christianity as a whole. And so I'm very particular and very careful about that. And I think that pastors have a responsibility to be careful about that. And so I think this pastor either needs to say, like, look, this was a complete mistake, and, you know, just recognize that and work and, you know, accept consequences that come and move forward. Or, you know, maybe he just needs to own, like, no, this is who I am. And then, you know, people need to be able to make a decision based on that. You can't pretend as a pastor, as a public figure, you can't pretend that you have complete privacy when you're online. You just can't pretend that that's a possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I think this one is tough. I mean, obviously, we've spoken on our podcast about issues regarding race. I mean, I imagine you're a member of that congregation and you're a person of color. That would be troubling and would be mm-hmm. difficult. But I think this idea of, like, he liked a tweet, contracts canceled, ministries that they were doing, even, like, good ministries, you know, made harder for something as small as liking a tweet does seem like there should be and could be room for education instead of just jumping to cancellation.
Mm.
And I think that is where we're missing in cancel culture. That is kind of what, like, we're jumping immediately to these broad strokes of you did something I don't like, therefore you'll be punished, instead of therefore here's how we can educate and work together for something better. But this is not the point of the story. It's not this one instance. This is kind of an example of how many members of the evangelical community, maybe the mainstream Protestant community, feels that the culture is coming for them.
Mm-hmm.
That they are under fire from the secular culture around them. And this is just an example of that, because it's going to ultimately say, really, the point of this article is, hey, what goes around has come around.
Mm-hmm.
That the church really was engaging in this kind of cancel culture in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And now that cultural tides have shifted, the church is now experiencing the same things that they were doing then.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is a compelling argument here by the author Jonathan Merritt of this article. So when growing up, did you ever experience, like, church or see Christians engaging in, like, this idea of canceling or protesting or saying we're not going to engage in anything? Like, have you experienced that?
Absolutely. Let's just start there.
Yeah. Harry Potter's witchcraft, yep. Right? Yep. That was a big one. I mean, not in my like immediate circle, but I remember that being a big hot topic of Christians saying, "Oh, this is witchcraft. We need to get rid of that," completely ignoring, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia, which has a literal witch in it.
Yeah.
You know,
it's in the title.
It is. Yeah, for sure. I mean, this was something that I remember from my childhood. I didn't grow up in that circle. My parents, you know, we grew up in a Lutheran church, so we were not. We were not as strict on a lot of that stuff. It wasn't like I grew up in the no dancing, no alcohol, no whatever kind of household. It was more about learning to judge the difference between things and learning to take, you know, fiction for fiction and learning to separate what's happening in our world versus what's happening in a story versus what's happening on TV. And, you know, so my parents were more intentional about helping me find nuance in those kind of scenarios. But I definitely remember this sort of thing happening.
Yeah, I do too. And I just want to say, I think, like, the whole purity culture movement in the 90s is essentially at its core, like, one facet of cancel culture, mm-hmm, too, mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was, like, thankfully my parents were not, like, super heavily involved in, like, purity culture and that kind of thing. I was Presbyterian, too, so, like, one step removed from, you know, the Southern Baptist Convention and that kind of stuff. But, like, I do remember that. I had tons of friends that were super involved in purity culture. And looking back, I can definitely see, like, how that shaped, like, my view of sexuality all the way through, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think these are, you know, great examples of that. I've got some from the article here that in 1997, the Southern Baptist Convention boycotted Walt Disney, which they perceived to be too gay friendly. And this is not the first time Disney has come under fire from evangelicals. In the latest Star Wars movie, there is a lesbian kiss at the very end. It happens in the background. It's pretty
mild. If you weren't looking for it, you wouldn't see it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not like a centerpiece of the film.
Absolutely not. It's the two basically characters that you don't know anything about. It happens in the background. And that's come under fire, you know, for including that. And then having Captain Marvel being a feminist icon in the Marvel movie from last year, that also came under fire from activists out there against that.
Okay, I don't know anything about Marvel comics, but wasn't Captain Marvel always a feminist icon?
Well, I mean, she's a female superhero, right? But you know,
sketchy. So,
it's not like they like made that up. Like this has been.
She's not a stay-at-home mom, okay?
Right. Like, that was not Captain Marvel.
Crossing so many lines.
And then a few years ago, at the latest Beauty and the Beast remake, the live-action one, some anger over LeFou being portrayed as gay in, again, one scene. If you did not think that they were trying to go for that, I'm not even sure you would land on that. Plus, in the animated version, that dude is obsessed with Gaston.
Absolutely, so, yeah.
I'm not sure that's a huge leap.
The source material the is there, you know.
But we've seen this. Okay, so that's Christians, or maybe even more evangelical side and more conservative Christian side, coming after Disney. In 1999, Jerry Falwell Sr., founder of the Moral Majority, led efforts to boycott Teletubbies because Tinky Winky is gay.
Yep.
That's the purple one who carries a purse.
Obviously.
They don't say words. They seem fairly asexual to me, but it's indoctrination. The 1 Million Moms in 2012 led a boycott of JCPenney because Ellen DeGeneres was named their spokesperson. She is famously out as a lesbian. So these are things that cancel culture has come after from the Christian side of things. And we probably could mention more and more things, especially as we kind of thought of like, oh yeah, I remember this from Dungeons and Dragons to I remember Titanic was under fire because it was PG-13 and Kate Winslet is briefly exposed in the movie. And so that was under fire. We met with the aforementioned Harry Potter. Things like this are easy to kind of get behind of like, they are easy for groups of Christians to get behind and say like, they should not exist in our culture. But we've seen the tide now shift, right? Like that now the culture has grown more secular, more LGBTQ affirming and accepting. And so now the weapon that the church used to use is now being used against them. And I think this is really interesting, right? So like that now Christians can find themselves under fire for previously held beliefs that were the norm in society, or at least accepted as the norm in society, now no longer are. And so now plenty of Christians out there are crying foul over this. So what do we think about this? That this idea that evangelicals or the Christian church kind of started an idea of cancel culture.
I think it's a reasonable critique. I think, you know, in general, I am probably not going to come down on the same side of this sort of a situation as the evangelical community. so that's probably not shocking. I think that, you know, as a church, we need to be aware that what we say matters and holds weight. And we need to be able to, or we need to be willing to accept the ramifications for that, right? And so if we believe firmly in what we're saying, we need to be willing to accept being canceled. Christianity probably did kind of start this. I mean, we kind of brought this on ourselves in some ways. But if you're going to be out there expressing your views, whatever those might be, you know, you have in this country, you have the freedom of speech, and other people have the freedom to respond to your speech. Your freedom of speech does not come without consequences. It just means you're allowed to say it. So as a Christian too, right? If I want to get up and espouse a particular belief, even if that's in line with the gospel of Jesus Christ, that doesn't protect you from the, you know, the ramifications of the world. It might protect you in the eyes of God. It doesn't protect you from the world in which we live. I will probably tend to disagree with what you think is in line with the eyes of God, and that's a whole nother conversation. But what we say matters, and what we say has weight, and other people are going to respond to that, and we have to be expecting that. And Paul was put in prison for preaching Jesus Christ on multiple occasions. You know, most of the apostles were martyred in one way or another. Christians died for their faith because they refused to bow to the emperor. They were martyred for this stuff. So we should not be surprised if we express an opinion that is maybe unpopular with the world, and there are consequences for that. That shouldn't come as a shock as a Christian.
Yeah.
I think one thing that kind of struck me when I was reading that article is how that sort of evangelical cancel culture was sort of a knee-jerk reaction to, like, free love, 60s and 70s, and what they saw as sort of, like, the downfall of culture, I guess. But the thing that's, like, troubling to me about that is this sort of us against them mentality that the church, I think, has had, at least since then. But I don't think that that is at all, excuse me, biblical. I think it's supposed to be us for them, not us against them. So, like, where do we get that from, even?
Where do we also, get the us against them mentality?
Yeah.
That's a great question. Of where do we get that from? I know you have more to say here, Lisa. I want to marinate on that a little bit.
Okay.
Because I think that's something interesting. I think that tribalism, I think it's partly this union, especially I think between Christians on the right and politics on the right have kind of married one another. So conservative Christianity and conservatism politically have kind of joined forces in a sense. And so anything against one is against the other. And so I think that is probably part of that. And so I do think, though, I mean, even if you're like, I think, whatever, anything against non-traditional marriage is a sin, I feel like you would naturally land on that from reading scripture that these people are, like myself, hostages to sin, not the enemy. like that they would be, like that you would land on, this is a person who desperately needs Jesus Christ. That's how I would read the Bible. Now, again, I don't subscribe to that theology or that mentality, but I can't imagine walking away from scripture and landing on anybody who does not identify or believe in Jesus and does something wrong is the bad guy, as kind of you mentioned, Lisa. Like, the church is supposed to be for those people because Jesus is for those people. I mean, Jesus is for the prostitute, and that doesn't mean he's for prostitution.
Yeah.
And so that is something that matters, and I do think that is a powerful thing that oftentimes we have forgotten in the church, or especially seeing parts of the church have forgotten. And I guess, like, if you engage in what you think is a culture war, you should not be surprised when the enemy, and I'm using enemy in quotes, fires back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you should not be surprised by that. If this is how you perceive the world, you should not be surprised, you know, that there's going to be combatants in this war.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Elise. I'm sorry to cut you off there.
Well, that was basically what I was going to say, is you should have seen this coming. You know, if you go in with this attitude of us against them, like, of course there's going to be pushback.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not surprising.
You know, I think we can really, if we go back in Christian history, right, we can even trace this kind of us versus them mentality back, I would say, back to Constantine, who's kind of the first great Christian emperor, right, who comes in, has a vision that Jesus tells him to put a cross on his shields, and then he's going to win this battle, and he does win the battle, and so then he and the entire Roman emperor become Christian basically overnight. And there's a whole lot of debate over the accuracy, legitimacy of that story, of his own beliefs and all this stuff, but what we do know is that Christianity gains power and goes from being an underground movement for the people on the margins to being the power structure of an empire. And as soon as you're in the position of power, you have to hold on to that power. And so anyone who's outside of that power, anyone who challenges the beliefs of that power is a threat, which is why Galileo was a threat when he said, hey, maybe the world doesn't revolve around us. Maybe, we revolve around other things, right? That's a threat because it's not, in line with the teachings of the church. And then we fast forward, and the threats change, but the idea that we have to hold on to this little bit of power remains the same, even though that's never what Jesus called us to. That's not the biblical narrative that's set up for us, and I don't think it's what our calling is even now. I think there's a genuine sense of, if you're outside of this, right, here's what we believe, here's what we teach, if you're outside of that, you are a threat to us being able to maintain our way of life.
Cancel culture existed for years upon years before the 60s and 70s. We just called it excommunication.
Right.
Like, that's, you know,
back
it's just
in the good old days.
Different.
Right.
Yeah. Like, it was just called something different. Martin Luther was canceled by the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. So what I do find interesting about this, though, because this is not just... Now, that maybe was the problem with the church in the, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Now, the alt-left on Twitter has its own box of theology
mm-hmm.
that everything needs to conform to, and anything outside of that is also a threat.
Mm-hmm.
It has its own standards, ideals, and has its own purity tests going on. This is a thing, like... J.K. Rowling was canceled by the church, and
so
recently
hard.
She was canceled by the left.
Sure was, yep.
for her views that she wrote about the transgender community and separating transgender women from biological women, are seeing two different needs or two different things there. Immediately, boom, canceled. Again, I'm not here to defend J.K. Rowling. She... is a billionaire. She can do that herself.
Right.
And I certainly don't know enough about the situation to even speak to it, but I can say the person who was canceled by the right all of a sudden found herself outside of the left purity box and was canceled again.
Yeah.
And so, this is going to happen too. So I cancel culture makes me nervous, because what happens... when the views of today that are the norms, and that I expose at 40, then I get to 60 and 70, and all those views of the day change, and I didn't change along with them.
Yeah.
Is all of a sudden...
Or you didn't even know they changed, right?
Or I'm not on Twitter, and all of a sudden, here's, a sermon that you gave, Pastor David, or here's something I said in youth group, or here's this thing that the culture changed, and all of a sudden we find ourselves canceled because I'm outside of that ideological purity that both sides have, and therefore kind of a threat.
Yeah.
That's a thing. So I do have a question is, can you become uncanceled? If you get canceled, what happens? Like, is it like, well, I guess I just have to live in my house and... delete my social media and it's over, because I'm not a billionaire, so I don't have that to fall back on, as J.K. Rowling does.
I think that's one interesting thing about the Twitter mob, though, is that it does blow over so quickly. Like, normally people get canceled, but normally it's a matter of months and everybody's forgotten about it. They've moved on to the next, big thing, cancel somebody else.
But have those people gotten uncanceled, I think, is a reasonable question, right? Have they regained whatever position they have, or have they, and sometimes they should and sometimes they shouldn't, right? I mean, let's take an example of a church, right? If I heard a member of council, let's say, we'll try to give this a more concrete example. If I hear a member of council spouting off on Facebook horribly racist ideologies, whatever it is, right? There are ramifications that we would hold them to at the church, right? Because you're a member of council, you're speaking not just as yourself, but you're representing the congregation. We have a code of conduct that we expect you to abide by, all this stuff, right? And so they would, in a sense, be canceled for that, even if they were apologetic. And there's a process that we go through. This isn't just like a Twitter mob, but, if they were going through that, they'd probably be taken off of council. And there'd be a consultation with a path, hopefully, towards reconciliation and forgiveness. And I think that's the piece that the church can offer that the mob of Twitter does not, right? That we want to ultimately offer a path towards reconciliation and forgiveness. And so can you be uncanceled? I would hope in the church you can be uncanceled, because I hope that we are people who teach reconciliation and forgiveness. I don't know that the Twitter mob can uncancel you.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. Like, what do you want? Do you want change or do you want revenge? And that's a big piece that's a thing about cancel culture that bothers me. An example for you, a writer who's big in the sci-fi fantasy community just recently fell prey to the Twitter mob off of something that he said at a convention 10 years ago.
Wow. Yeah.
So, you know, I firmly believe, you know, believe victims, believe women with their experiences and stuff like that. It fell within the bounds of sexual harassment. I'm not going to get into it in detail. But since that time, 10 years ago, he has apologized. He has stopped drinking. He has sought therapy. He has limited his convention attendance. So he did all these things, and then it came out after that that they wanted him to be canceled, essentially, all of this. And so I'm not saying, like, that he doesn't deserve to have ramifications for something that he said or did at a convention that was harmful. It was really harmful. But how effective is that, you know, and mm-hmm. why at the end of the day, you know, if he's already made these steps to, you know, hopefully reconcile and fix his issues and everything like that, like, what is the point? What is your goal? Are you just angry still? Mm-hmm. Or do you really want things to get better?
Yeah, I think that question, are you just angry still, is a really valuable one, because I don't think we as a culture have a method or a practice for dealing with our anger in a healthy way. And so I think our anger comes out, you know, in Twitter mobs, and our anger comes out in Facebook arguments. And, you know, and I don't think it's unique to this time, but I think in this time we're particularly experiencing this, right, with, you know, all the heightened attention around being in our own homes and with our own families and not being able to do the things that we want to do. Like, I think we are all on, like, level alert 5, like, we're just rearing and ready to go. If you're going to threaten anything near something that I believe, I'm on it and I'm ready to attack. And we don't have a healthy sense of how do I separate my anger about this from, not from the person, how do I handle my anger in a way that acknowledges the humanness of the other person, and demands change, right? Because his behavior was inappropriate. His behavior warrants change and warrants
And consequences. You know,
repentance and forgiveness and consequences, all that, yes. But how do I separate my anger from that? Which is one of the things that, I don't know how to say this quite, but even when we're, you know, thinking about the Me Too movement and the Church Too movement within the church, right? You know, in the United States, we have a judicial system, flawed as it absolutely is at times, but we have a judicial system predicated on the premise that you are innocent until proven guilty. And, you know, we can go around that forever about, you know, the effectiveness of that and how it's been abused and mistreated. But the Twitter mob jumps to guilty before trial, right? That, you know, I make an accusation or I bring up something that you said 10 years ago, there's no opportunity for a response, there's no opportunity for a rebuttal, there's no opportunity for a conversation, as I think Patrick mentioned early on in this episode, right? There's no place of, well, not that I need to justify my behavior, but before I can even apologize for my behavior, before I can even genuinely do that, I'm being accosted by, you know, the threats, and everybody else is coming after this, and there's no room for reconciliation or forgiveness at that point, because then my defenses go up, right? That then, rather than being able to enter into a space of wanting to apologize and make amends, I go up into a protective mode of, well, I've got to defend my own kingdom, so to speak.
Sure.
Yeah, I think for me, for how to get uncancelled, and I can't speak for the culture, so I will speak for the church, is one step is to have the same level of expectation that you do for the outsider that you also place on the insider.
Yes.
So that it's not just somebody who I perceive as the enemy already did something wrong, and so I use that against them. But if an insider, one of my allies, one of my friends, one of the people I respect and love, does the same, you know, action, well, then there's nuance. Then they're part of the good old boys club. Then there's for grace and forgiveness, and then their apology is taken at face value. I think if that's the case, offer that same grace to those that are already, that you think are against you. And this is not just a church issue. This isn't just Christians have done this. I think you know, like off the top of my head, like Mel Gibson said some awful things about the Jewish community, some really sexist things, was canceled by Hollywood. And understandably so, but he was a bit of an outsider because he was an outspoken Christian. It was easy to cancel that. Later at the Oscars, Roman Polanski, convicted rapist, gets a standing ovation. And so, you know, again, I'm like, that seems like something you'd want to cancel too.
Yeah.
But he's an insider, so it's kind of protected. The church does this all the time. So anybody that they see as an insider, they're protected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the pastor that's accused of sexual assault is protected by the congregation. The actor accused of sexual assault is part of what's wrong with the sexual ethics of our culture today. Like, separating those two things. Mm-hmm. And I think that that needs to change. So I think part of the church can lead the way of saying, like, we have the same standards no matter what. And one of those standards is a high ethical standards, but also a high redemptive process of that there is chances for redemption and reconciliation. And that does not mean that the pastor who violates their oath and their call gets to become a pastor again, but it does mean that they get to be valued as a human again.
Mm-hmm.
Same as just like any other profession. You know, if you're an actor and you do something wrong, it doesn't necessarily mean you get to be an actor again. Like, you don't necessarily get to go do that same job and have that same public influence and the same thing again, but you can still be valued as a human again. And that is, I think, an important aspect of that. And I'm hopeful, maybe I shouldn't be, but I'm hopeful that the church can lead the way, that this is what it's supposed to look like, that this is what redemption looks like. So more than anything, of the people I perceive as my either political enemies or my cultural enemies, I'd rather have them redeemed than punished.
Yeah.
As much as I want them punished, I'd rather have redemption attached to that.
Sure. Because
punishment only moves on to somebody else. Because then the next person, the next head of the Hydra arises, and we go after that one next. But redemption is an amazing process. It transforms Saul into Paul, and that's a powerful thing. You know, an enemy into an ally is a powerful thing. Way better than an enemy into just somebody who we just pretend never existed.
Yeah.
And I don't think that works.
I think that's a great point, Patrick. I think maybe this is a topic for another podcast episode, but talking about the differences between restorative justice and retributive justice. And I think that's really what you're getting at, that we want to have an opportunity to restore people to right relationship with one another and with God. That's what the church should be leading the charge for. And most of our punitive systems in churches and in culture are not set up to do that.
Yeah. Well, I think, I don't know, anybody else have anything else? I think I've said everything I can say about this topic.
Yeah, sorry, I ended up kind of on a downer there, my bad.
I think that, you know, going back to what you were saying about, like, insiders being protected, I think so much of cancel culture does stem from a frustration from insiders being protected. And mm-hmm. it would be probably wholly unnecessary if we did a better job of dealing with the issues earlier on.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and again, you could probably trace this from the church to Hollywood to politics. Every group that has an inside and outside has done this.
Yep.
This is not a one world view issue. This is an issue that exists within humanity. But I'm hopeful the church can lead the way in resolving and restoring that issue to something that is right. Because I believe in the truth of Jesus Christ, and if I believe in that, I just have hope that the followers of Jesus can act like Jesus.
I
have greater hope for that than asking non-followers of Jesus to act like Jesus, you know?
Seems like a reasonable cause, yeah.
All right, why don't you shut us down.
All right, let's wrap it up. Hey, if you liked what you heard today, or if you have questions about what you heard, we want to hear from you. So be sure to send us a note. You can talk to us on Facebook, or of course, send us an email at beyondsundaypodcast@gmail.com. You can share this episode or any of our past episodes. I think we've got 95 now with this one.
Woo.
You know, any of those episodes are out there and available for you to share with your friends and family for all of your quarantining pleasure. We know that you've burned through all the other stuff that you listen to, so go ahead and share out Beyond Sunday as well. We'd love to hear what you're thinking about our material that we're putting out, and we hope that you are having a great week.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is our 95 thesis, this podcast. We will nail a flash drive filled with these podcasts on the church doors.
That'll be ineffective because that'll break the flash drive, Patrick. You can't.
It's got like a little hoop on the end for your keychain.
Like a key ring. Okay, we're going to put a nail and we're going to hang the flash drive by a key ring.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week.